Professor Eugene Nagasawa, welcome and how are you?
Good, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Before we start, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, so I'm Eugene Nagasawa. I'm originally from Japan, but now I teach in the United States. So I currently hold a professorship and of philosophy and Kingfisher College Chair of the Philosophy, Religion, and Ethics at the University of Oklahoma. Before coming to the UK, US, I taught in the UK for 18 years at the University of Birmingham. And I specialize in the philosophy of mind and the philosophy of religion. And I have written books about the existence of God, the problem of evil, the problem of consciousness, miracles, and so on. And I have written some papers on applied ethics as well.
Why choose philosophy? What were the reasons?
I always like all of these big questions. So when I was a teenager, I was quite attracted to science initially. So I like to collect fossils and insects, and you know, I love animals as well. So I wanted to be a scientist at one point, especially a physicist, because I thought it would be quite fascinating to explore the structure of reality. But then one day I read a philosophy book, and I was really intrigued because it looks like, you know, philosophers are interested in the structure of reality, but in a deeper way. So philosophers talk about, you know, things beyond the material universe. So philosophers talk about morality and meaning and even the foundation of science as well. And then I decided that I really wanted to become an academic specializing philosophy.
How did it feel to learn philosophy and learning new mindset about the reality? How did it feel?
I mean, for me, it has always been, you know, really exciting to explore all the philosophical questions. I think academics are good at complaining about their jobs and life in general, but I feel that, you know, I'm so privileged to be able to make a living from teaching and learning what I love. And I attend philosophy conferences around the world to meet interesting researchers, and also to teach, you know, young, bright people to discuss interesting philosophical questions. So I, you know, I love my job and I feel very privileged.
How did the difference between Eastern and Western culture affect you in academia? And given your educational background in philosophy of religion, you learned it at the Western part of the world. Were such differences affect your beliefs as well?
Yeah, so I was born and grew up in Japan. I was there until when I was 21. But I did my undergraduate in the United States and a PhD in Australia. And I had jobs in Canada, the UK, and the US as well. So, you know, I have been mainly trained in the English-speaking part of the world. But yeah, as you say, the Eastern culture is quite different from the Western culture. So, for example, in Japan, you know, philosophy is quite remote, especially Western philosophy. The way we discuss arguments and ideas, it's quite different, because in philosophy, often the purpose is to, you know, develop your own argument to persuade others that your argument is sound. And as a critic, you might try to analyze someone else's argument, try to find the problems in them. And, you know, sometimes people in the East, they consider this kind of activity a little bit impolite because it's not nice to find a flaw in someone's reasoning or try to show that they're wrong. So I try to think that philosophy is more like a collaborative project. So I don't want to think that philosophy is a blood sport where, you know, I try to persuade that you're wrong and I'm right. And the way I look at philosophy is not like that. I want to think that, you know, we are all fellow explorers. We are addressing interesting and difficult questions together, and so we can help each other. So when if I, you know, I'm happy to receive criticisms from my students and colleagues, and I do criticize other people's works, but the criticisms should be always constructive. It's not like the purpose shouldn't be to destroy your argument, but to, you know, try to help you to improve your argument. So that's how I try to see philosophy.
Is there any Japanese people that read your books or maybe your articles where you criticize other and they start to think that for a Japanese people you are extremely impolite? Have you ever experienced that?
I'm not sure. I have met some Japanese scholars, but they didn't necessarily express a view like that. But maybe that's precisely because they are polite. Sure. So they might feel quite uncomfortable to read some of my work. But yeah, I don't know. I think younger generations are different, I think. Now, younger philosophers in Japan, they are many of them are familiar with analytic philosophy, and they read papers and books written by analytic philosophers in the West. So they, I think, they're getting used to the way we do philosophy. But ordinary people might feel sometimes uncomfortable about reading, you know, intense discussions among philosophers.
Yeah, because in my culture in Indonesia, arguing with others considered as impolite as well. And I believe Japanese people have some kind of similar culture about that. So, yeah, I just want to
I
know
think
how do you.
it's yeah, it's similar. I
Yeah,
think that people in many Asian countries, they try to, instead of finding out who is correct, you know, we try to find a, you know, harmonious try to build a harmonious relationship so that we can agree on something that is common, rather than find, you know, deciding, you know, who is correct and who is wrong, which is, I think it's a virtue, and I think we can do philosophy in that way. Of course, you know, in philosophy, it's very important to develop your own ideas and develop arguments for your theses and so on. So that's unavoidable. But I think philosophy can be still developed in a, you know, harmonious and polite way. So when I teach, I encourage students to, you know, to do philosophy together as a collaborative project.
Do you dream one day you'll coming home to Japan and teach philosophy there?
Probably not. I have been
Why?
away from Japan for so many years, and more than
Yeah.
20, nearly 30 years, and
So you
I don't
spend
think I
more
can
time.
teach. Yeah, I don't think I can teach philosophy in Japanese.
I want to know this. One reason I choose to use English in my philosophy contents is because I find my language, Indonesian language, is very restricted in terms of choice of words for expressing philosophical ideas. Do you think Japanese language experienced that as well?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Even the term of philosophy, when that was imported to Japan, they have to, you know, create a new term, really artificially. Or when I read, you know, I rarely read philosophy books in Japanese, but sometimes when I read it, you know, there are some very unusual terms. So, for example, supervenience, it's a technical term in English, and that's, you know, that was translated into Japanese, but they had to just make up a unique word for that. So philosophy can look quite artificial when it's translated from English to Japanese.
But I think for the sake of the future of philosophy, we mostly Asian Eastern countries have to develop our own. I think we have to develop our own words and terms for so we can engage more in the world of philosophy. What do you think about that?
Yeah, sometimes people worry that, English is always prioritized and non-English speakers, they have to learn English to communicate with others. Some people think that that's unfair. But I think that's practically speaking, that's unavoidable. And that's what it's done in science. So if you look at the natural sciences and social sciences, people use English as a common language. But of course, if you want to study Indonesian philosophy or French philosophy or whatever, you have to learn their languages as well. You cannot do authentic Indonesian language without speaking the language itself. So I think learning foreign languages can be quite important too.
Before we move on with the discussion, just one more question. Back then, I read in Wikipedia that you are one of the proponents of the ontological argument for the existence of God. Is that true?
Right.
And if true, why?
Yeah, so I have written some papers and also a book titled Maximal God. And in these works, I defend the ontological argument. I find it a very fascinating argument, and it's a powerful argument for the existence of God. Certainly, it's not fashionable. I think many theists defend the fine-tuning argument and cosmological argument, but there are very few theistic philosophers who defend the ontological argument. But I think it's a very powerful argument. I mean, actually, if you look at the history of the argument, there have been very prominent proponents like, Anselm, Descartes, Leibniz, Gödel, Plantinga. So these are, some of the most distinguished scholars in the history of philosophy. And I'm inclined to agree with them that, this argument is very powerful. There is no obvious flaw in the argument. I wouldn't say that this is a mathematical proof of the existence of God, but I would say that this argument is as powerful as any other arguments, philosophical arguments that are considered powerful. So I think this is a good argument for the existence of the greatest possible being or that which no greater can be thought, as Anselm put.
But you do realize that many people not took this argument seriously, right? I mean, if you watch many philosophy videos, they usually made a tier list about arguments of the existence of God, and they usually make ontological arguments in, like C or D tier. You do realize about that, right? What do you res How do you respond with that?
Yeah, I think often people think that the ontological argument is just a logical puzzle or something. It's not a serious argument to demonstrate the existence of God. So Schopenhauer said that the ontological argument is a charming joke. but I think it's more than that. Again, I mean, especially I like the model ontological argument. And if you look at the structure of the argument, it's logically valid. For me, there is no obvious problem with the premises. So the conclusion seems to follow. Of course, you can raise objections to the argument, which need to be taken seriously. But I would say that it's a very powerful argument, which tend to be overlooked by philosophers.
Okay, next up, we are going to discuss about your latest project, the Global Philosophy of Religion. What is that?
Yeah, so this was a project that I led at the University of Birmingham in the UK for 3 years. And this project was funded by the John Templeton Foundation. I launched this project because I wanted to really globalize the philosophy of religion. So if you look at the analytic philosophy of religion, most scholars have focused on the Judeo-Christian concept of God, and even atheists who criticize theism, they tend to focus on the Judeo-Christian concept of God. But if you look at the world, especially Indonesia and other places in Southeast Asia, there's a huge diversity of religion. There are so many different religious beliefs, and if we want to take religion seriously, we have to look at other traditions as well. And also there are a lot of interesting researchers around the world. So I wanted to expand the scope of the philosophy of religion and diversify the field. So through the project, we collaborated with scholars in all over the world, but especially Asia, Africa, Latin America, and the Middle East. So we had funding programs to support the research projects of these philosophers around the world. And also we had a funding competition to translate philosophy books from English to another language or vice versa. We also organized many conferences, inviting speakers representing diverse religious and cultural backgrounds. And also we worked with Closer to Truth, which is an American TV series and a YouTube channel. And we have made 10 TV episodes focusing on global philosophy of religion. So Robert Lawrence Kuhn, the host and creator of the program, he interviewed many philosophers representing diverse backgrounds.
Is there any particular belief system that fascinates you the most when you're hosting the project there? And which is it?
I mean, I would say, you know, all traditions are interesting in their own ways. And what's interesting for me is that, you know, this diversity is so amazing. There are so many different beliefs. You know, some religious pluralists claim that, you know, all the religious traditions, they are ultimately the same thing. All followers of distinct traditions, they ultimately, you know, have some common beliefs. But my view is almost the opposite of that. So I would say that religion is amazing because it's so diverse. There are so many fascinating beliefs in different regions and cultures. So I don't have any favorite religious tradition.
Do you encounter Sufism? I was a Sufi. I literally born and raised within the Sufi community. So yeah, I kind of curious. Do you encounter any Sufis out there? And how was your encounter?
There are some Sufis that we have collaborated with. Yeah, I found Sufism interesting because it's a, as I understand, it's a mystical tradition. And in analytic philosophy religion, especially, we tend to focus on propositional beliefs. But in these mystical traditions, they try to approach ultimate reality from a, you know, mystical perspective. So that's, this kind of tradition is very interesting to address. And it's completely overlooked in analytic philosophy religion.
So there's just one more question that I want to ask. So before we move out to the next topic. So Sufism concepts of God is rather similar with what we call with pantheism and panentheism. Now, I'm not saying that they hold such beliefs, but they have some similarities. I still don't really understand the concept of Sufism that much because frankly, I left Sufism in 2 years ago before I kind of learned a lot. But one of the lingering thought that I still have up until now, and even it still motivate my kind of, if God exists, I would consider that kind of God is some kind of pantheistic or panentheistic God. Now, what do you think about pantheism and panentheism?
So, yeah, pantheists normally believe that the universe is God. It's not that God created the universe, but the universe itself is God. And panentheists, their belief is somewhere between traditional theism and pantheism. So they think that God is not identical with the universe, but the universe is part of God. Yeah, so we are probably part of God as well, even though obviously we are not identical with God. These are very interesting views. It's distinct from the traditional concept of God, which says that, you know, God Long time
Extinct?
ago, there was just God alone, but God decided to create a universe, and therefore there is God. So there's a clear distinction between God and the universe. I can see some attractions because many people find that there is something divine about the universe. There's something amazing about the universe, even holy about the universe. So you might think that maybe the universe is part of God, or universe is even identical with God. But I'm not sure ultimately it works. So in my recent book, I tried to raise certain problems, certain versions of the problem of evil for pantheists and panentheists. So I think it's quite difficult to say, the universe includes all kinds of horrific things. And sometimes it seems difficult to say that, they are part of God. The universe includes all sorts of ugly, horrible, nasty things. And how can we say that they are still part of God? So I think that's a challenge for pantheists and panentheists. But generally speaking, I like to explore these alternative concepts of God, because again, philosophers of religion in the West tend to focus on just the traditional concept of God, which is distinct from these pantheistic and panentheistic concepts.
So, yeah, let's talk about your latest book, The Problem of Evil for Atheists. I've read the book and it kind of fascinates me and kind of triggered me in a good way sense, a little, but we'll get into that a little bit. First of all, what motivated you to write the book?
I mean, in a way, it's kind of related to my ambition to globalize the philosophy of religion. So, if you look at the standard literature on the problem of evil, again, the focus is the traditional concept of God versus evil. So, J.L. Mackey, who was a prominent atheistic philosopher, he said that, the problem of evil, at least the version that he presents, is a specific problem for traditional theists who believe that there is a God who is omnipotent and morally perfect. Because, how could there be wars and natural disasters and horrible things in this world if God created the world and God is meant to be all powerful, all powerful and all good? So that's the traditional formulation of the problem of evil. But I thought that in a way that's correct, but I think the general problem is much deeper than that. So it's not just about God versus evil. Because even if you are an atheist or pantheist or whatever, you can still wonder, how come this world is, at least part of this world, is so horrible? How come there has to be pain and suffering in this world? And I think that's the foundation of the problem of evil. And especially if you hold an optimistic worldview. So if you want to think that the world is fundamentally good, or at least not a bad, then the existence of pain and suffering in this world is a, serious existential threat for you. So that's the motivation to work on this book project.
In one of the part of the introduction of the book, you said that everyone must treat the problem of evil seriously. Surely we cannot expect everyone to be, philosophically literate in order to treat it seriously. Like, I mean, problem of evil mostly is a philosophical problem and theological problem, and we cannot. Sure, we can. Surely we cannot expect all people to be philosophically literate to study the problem of evil, right? In what way that you expected people to treat the problem of evil seriously?
Okay, so I guess I have 2 points in response to your comment. So the first is what's interesting about the problem of evil in general is that it's not a pure philosophical problem or an intellectual problem. So philosophers tend to find the problem of evil really fascinating because it's a very interesting intellectual puzzle. There is God, all powerful, all loving being on the one hand, and evil on the other hand. how could they be compatible? And that's an interesting logical or intellectual puzzle. But also the problem of evil can raise an existential concern for many people. You know, people encounter the death of their friends and family members, or they encounter horrific events in the world. And then, you know, they can wonder, you know, ordinary theists or even atheists, they can wonder, you know, how come this world is so horrible, and how could there be so many horrific things in the world? And I think that's basically the problem of evil. That's the core of the problem of evil. So I would say the problem of evil, or at least its core, is not just a problem for intellectuals like philosophers. And the second point that I wanted to mention was, now I'm almost forgetting. Maybe you will come back.
Okay. All right. Okay. Next questions. There's one sentence.
Sorry. Now I remember.
Okay, you remember.
Now I remember. Okay. Yes. Now I remember. The other thing that I wanted to say was that I'm not saying that the problem of evil is a problem for absolutely everyone. Because, for example, if you are a pessimist, if you have a pessimistic worldview, mm-hmm. the problem of evil doesn't arise. So the core of my argument is that the problem of evil is a problem for anyone who holds a largely optimistic worldview. So if you think that, you know, the world is expected to be horrible, then this is not a problem, because there is no mismatch between your expectation of how reality should be and how reality is. So if you're a theist, you would think that the world was created by an all-loving, all-good, all-powerful being. So your expectation is pretty high. So the existence of pain and suffering in the world is quite surprising. And also, even if you're an atheist, if you believe that the world is overall and fundamentally good or not bad, then, you know, when you encounter this horrific things in the world, you might find it find the reality unexpected. So a version of the problem of evil can arise for you without endorsing theism. But if you are a pessimist, if you think that, you know, the world is just expected to be horrible, and it is indeed horrible, mm-hmm. then there is no expectation mismatch, which is my terminology. So the problem of evil doesn't arise for you.
So do you more of a optimist or a pessimist, Professor?
I want to embrace optimism. So one way of looking at my book is to say that it is difficult to maintain optimism without supernaturalism. Because I say that, okay, the problem of evil is a problem for all optimists, but there can be a good solution only for supernaturalist optimists. So my view is that it's very difficult to maintain optimism if you are a naturalist who believe that this material universe is all there is. When we die, that's the end of our existence. It's very difficult to maintain optimism if your worldview is like that. So my claim is that it's very difficult to embrace optimism without supernaturalism. And I want to embrace optimism, which means that I would have to be a supernaturalist. That doesn't mean that supernaturalism is true. So I'm not saying that the problem of the existence of the pain and the suffering in this world proves the truth of supernaturalism. But my claim is that if you think that there is a successful solution to the problem of evil, you probably have to embrace supernaturalism.
I consider myself as a naturalist, and I believe Professor Graham Oppie is a naturalist as well, if I'm not mistaken. Before I have a conversation with him back in February, I was a very, very pessimistic person. But when I had a conversation with him, I asked things about moral problems in this universe, in this world, And he really have a quite optimistic outlook in the world. I kind of want to push back a little bit, Professor, because I think I'm actually quite an optimistic person, but I do not really believe about the existence of supernatural.
Right.
Okay, what's your what's your response?
My response would be that okay, if naturalists can really embrace optimism, that's great. I'll be happy with that. If we can hold that this material universe is all there is, our physical death is the end of our existence, and we could still embrace optimism, that's fine. That's great. But I say that that's very, very difficult. I mean, you might think that if you are a very wealthy, healthy person who would live for a long time and have a happy life, then you might think that okay, at least I can embrace optimism because I have had a very good life. But even so, if you look at other people's lives or other sentient organisms' life on this planet, the nature is quite horrific. So in my book, I focus on natural selection as a biological system. And it seems to me that natural selection guarantees that constantly there are millions of billions of sentient animals who have to suffer all the time because natural selection is based on competition for survival. So nature is very cruel and violent and full of pain and suffering. And for me, it's very difficult to maintain optimism if we focus on natural selection, especially. That's why I think that if we believe that naturalism is true, then we have a very limited resources to maintain optimism.
I'm feeling like I want to make a full video response about this one because I find this is very fascinating. Please don't forget to subscribe to my channel, okay?
Sure.
Let's move on. There is one sentence that I really want to ask you directly. The problem of evil as a problem of axiological mismatch. That's a very interesting sentence. What do you mean by that?
So, again, the problem of evil is traditionally presented as an apparent incompatibility between the existence of God and the existence of evil. So God versus evil, that's the core of the problem of evil. That's why many philosophers think that this is a problem specifically for theists, because if you're happy to reject the existence of God, then the problem of evil doesn't arise. But I say the problem of evil is a version of what I call the problem of axiological expectation mismatch. So it's not just about God versus evil, but it's about how we expect the world to be and the reality that we observe. So the reality that we observe is that the world is filled with pain and suffering. And in a way, the fundamental biological system on which our existence is relying on, that's necessitates pain and suffering for people and animals all the time. So that's reality. And if you are an optimist, you would think that the world is overall and fundamentally good, or at least not bad. If you reject this expectation, you are basically a pessimist. So I would say, yeah, it's fine, you're a pessimist, so the problem of evil doesn't arise. But I would say that anyone, whether you're a pantheist or panentheist or a naturalist, if you think that the world is overall and fundamentally good, then you will face a version of the problem of evil. So if you're a pantheist, for example, you would claim that the world is, or the universe is divine or holy. And so the assumption is that, the material universe is somehow special in a positive way. So you have this positive axiological expectation mismatch. Sorry, the positive axiological expectation, which entails a mismatch, because if you think that the universe is amazing and holy and beautiful, how could there be pain and suffering? And it's not that the pain and suffering exist by accident. They are almost necessitated, nomologically necessitated by natural selection. So this whole system seems to be evil. I mean, there's a question about if we can ascribe this term to something that is not an agent. But the point is that, you know, how can we ascribe this kind of negative attributes to the fundamental system on which our existence is dependent?
In the pantheist part, you mentioned the divinity problem of evil for pantheists.
Right.
So what does it mean? What does it mean? Okay, for the divinity problem of evil for pantheists.
Yeah. So there is a well-known objection to pantheism, which I call the pantheism in atheism in disguise objection. Pantheists claim that the material universe is all there is. And it's so amazing that we consider it to be God. But some critics think that, that just means that pantheism is basically atheism. They just embrace the existence of the material universe and nothing else. And they just call the universe God. So pantheism is just a nominal thing. And pantheists are actually atheists. And then pantheists normally say that, that's not correct, because there is something very special about the universe. The universe, the material universe, is all there is, but we can correctly ascribe divinity or holiness to the universe. But that's quite difficult to do, because obviously pantheists cannot ascribe any supernatural attributes to the universe to make it divine or holy. Resources are limited to this universe itself. So often they appeal to experience. So they say that pantheists, they have some kind of almost like religious experience to recognize that the universe is holy or divine. But that's tricky as well, because many atheists, even Richard Dawkins, says that this universe is very special and amazing. We can almost worship the universe, even though the universe is not a person or an agent. So almost, if you just appeal to experience, even Richard Dawkins might be considered a pantheist, which is a little bit strange. So you have to appeal to something else. And one suggestion is to appeal to encompassment. So the universe is special because it subsumes everything there is. There's nothing beyond the universe. So this the extent of the ontological extent of the material universe is so amazing and special that we can call the universe God. That's one attempt. But then the problem is that if we appeal to encompassment, then of course we have to include not just all the beautiful things in the universe, but also horrible, ugly things. And again, I claim that nature itself is very cruel, violent, and horrific, because especially our biological existence is dependent on evolution and natural selection, which guarantees pain and suffering. So it seems difficult for pantheists to maintain that the universe is holy and divine. And that's a version of the problem of evil for pantheists. So my claim is that pantheists cannot say, we are not traditional theists. We don't believe in an all-powerful, all-loving God. So the problem of evil is not a problem for us. So I say, that's partly true, but there is a different version of the problem of evil for you guys as well.
Which is?
Which is this problem. The idea that, they cannot consider the universe divine or holy.
Divine.
Given the existence of pain and suffering.
Okay. I get it now. So that's one of the problems.
Yeah. At the very least, they have to address pain and suffering. And they have to reconcile the existence of pain and suffering with their pantheistic conception of God.
See. But my question is being divine entailed to be non-evil? Why should the pantheist accept that divinity has to be, omnibenevolent or all good? Why divine should be all good? Sorry, non-evil.
Right. So there are some religious traditions where divine beings or gods, perhaps, are not necessarily good. So there are some traditions, even pantheistic traditions, where God is considered to be partly evil or partly horrible. But then the question is, in what sense God in this tradition should be considered divine or holy? I mean, you can have a very unique concept of God, which says that God is by nature partly good and partly horrible, and that's fine in the sense that it's almost like a version of pessimism. So the expectation is that the world is pretty horrible. So if you believe that God can be both good and evil, then you're not embracing optimism, because your expectation is that the world is partly good and partly evil. So a version of the problem of evil does not arise for you. But my point is that in that case, you are a pessimist, according to my definition, because you don't think that the world or the universe is ultimately and fundamentally good or not bad. You are saying that the universe is ultimately and fundamentally bad. So that's a form of pessimism. So you are off the hook, but at the same time, you cannot embrace pun sorry, you cannot embrace optimism here.
See, okay. Yeah, so here's one. I think this is quite interesting. In Islam, there is a concept of Asma'ul Husna, which literally means the beautiful names. It's the names of the God Allah. It consists of 99 names. Most of the name denotes Allah's divinity, and most of the name mostly showcase that divinity, divine attributes. But there are some of the names like Al-Mumit, Al-Khafid, and Al-Qahar, which respectively means the bringer of death, the abaser, or the one who humiliates, and the subjugator. Now, I don't think that this is an all good trait to be having, but this is the part of the names of that God. My question is, isn't that shown to us that at least in Islam, their God doesn't necessarily, omnibenevolent? What do you think about that?
Yeah, so there are certain traditions like Islam, as you say, and also even certain traditions within Christianity. There's this idea that God is meant to be frightening or scary or possibly even violent and so on. And that's part of God's greatness. So you might think that that's compatible with the existence of pain and suffering in the world. But in these traditions, obviously, supernaturalism is assumed. So pain and suffering in this world, I mean, there has to be pain and suffering in this world, but there is something beyond that as well. But for pantheists or naturalists, there's nothing beyond the material universe. So pain and suffering is the necessary part of the existence of the material universe. So I think my argument is compatible with the idea that in certain supernaturalist traditions like Christianity and Islam, God can have certain aspects that are considered violent or horrific or even evil.
You said that Islam and Christianity as supernaturalist traditions. I think this is a new term for me as how you define that. Most people usually say that in certain theistic traditions. So, do you aware of that distinction you made?
Yeah. So by naturalism, I mean the view that this material universe is all there is.
That is,
maybe there are some abstract objects as well, like the laws of nature and other things. But there is no afterlife, no God beyond the material universe. So you might claim that there are certain traditions in Islam or Christianity which can be considered forms of pantheism or panentheism. I think it's quite difficult to embrace pantheism because pantheists don't believe in anything beyond this material reality. Yeah. Panentheism might be possible. I mean, there are some Christian or Islamic panentheists.
Panentheistic, yeah.
Because panentheists believe that, okay, the universe is part of God, but there is something beyond that. So it can allow certain reality beyond the material universe.
Yeah, dude. Fascinating. I guess I have to reread your book again. There is so much that I learned here, and I have to read another of your books. But personally, what is your opinion about the problem of evil? Your personal opinion. And what do you think the solutions are, if there are any?
Yeah, so in my book, I explicitly say that, you know, I'm not proposing any new solution to the problem of evil. I'm inclined to say that, you know, this is a very, very difficult problem, and there's no obvious solution to the problem. I mean, there are so many distinct responses to the problem of evil. So some philosophers, theistic philosophers, appeal to the greater good theodicy, saying that, okay, evil is necessary for realizing greater goods, like compassion and love. So, you know, God has to allow evil. Or some other people appeal to the soul-making theodicy, saying that, you know, we have to encounter evil for our spiritual growth and maturity and so on. So there are many different responses to the problem of evil. I don't think any of them is successful. I mean, you might be able to combine many of them to make a cumulative case, cumulative response to the problem of evil. But I don't think there's any obviously successful response to the problem. So I don't propose any new response because I cannot find any compelling response. But in partially defend theism, what I say is that, okay, if my argument is right, the problem of evil is a problem for almost everyone, except pessimists. And we all have to address this problem together. And theists are advantaged here because theists are supernaturalists and they can appeal to all sorts of supernaturalist resources. So they can appeal to God or the afterlife or, you know, those things that that are believed to exist beyond the material universe. And atheists or naturalists, they don't have these resources. So theists are more advantaged than atheists and naturalists in response to the problem of evil. So I claim that the problem of evil is a problem for almost everyone, and theistic supernaturalists are more advantaged than others. But I don't say that there is a successful theistic response to the problem.
Okay, so yeah, I guess we have to move on to the three closing questions that I want to ask.
Sure.
So the first question is, let's get back to your project, Global Philosophy of Religion. There are many extinct religions that, of course, cannot attend the project because they are extinct. right? Such as, Egyptian pantheon, Greek pantheon, or any other already extinct religion. Is there any now extinct religion that you really want to include it in your maybe next global philosophy of religion project?
Actually, that's a very interesting question because I haven't even thought about those religions that are no longer existent. My focus has been on living traditions where there are philosophers and followers who are actively practicing these religions. But you're right that there are certain traditions that are, no longer practiced, and there are obviously interesting beliefs and practices. There were beliefs and practices in those traditions as well. And obviously that, they can be part of global philosophy of religion as well. So I think that's a very good suggestion to explore these traditions as well.
I mean, it could be. I will use my own word here. It could be a lot cooler if at the next, project, you somehow encountered ancient Egyptianist philosopher. I think it will be a great story to tell. But of course, we cannot even imagine what it would look like. But
Some
to make a phil
people, some people focus on future religions or something similar to religions. So some people talk about transhumanism as a new form of religion, and they say that global philosophy religion should address that kind of new emerging tradition. And I think that's right. But I didn't even think about these traditions in the past. And I think that's a very interesting suggestion, and it's worth exploring.
So you don't. So you have no preference which kind of religion that you would like to see resurrected and come to your next project, Professor?
No, because because my knowledge is quite limited about what sort of traditions existed. Probably some of these polytheistic traditions in ancient times. I think they can be quite interesting because the focus has been on mainly monotheistic traditions. So Egyptian traditions or ancient Greek traditions, they can be very interesting to address.
I might get a little biased here, and this is quite off track actually. This is not included in my last questions. There's a belief system in the Javanese island of Indonesia. I'm not Javanese, so I'm not quite well acquainted with those belief systems. We call it Kejawen. So it's kind of a culmination between their animistic beliefs, their Hinduism, and Indonesian, and Sufism in some sense. So I think it's fascinating, and I really want to see those kind of belief systems presented themselves in global settings, because this kind of belief system is quite not No, don't have its place in the academic settings. People always see that as a superstitious here in Indonesia. This is just this is just for a thought for consideration for you maybe in the future to include a belief systems that's more remote in that sense. Because even Indonesia have that kind of unique belief system. Who knows that in many part of the world we have that kind of belief systems, right? I really fascinated by the project, and I wish in the future those kind of rather not weird, rather unusual belief system will be included. I think yeah
Yeah, I
but uh, do
think
you still
I think animism is very important because you can find many animistic beliefs in many different parts of the world. And there's a question about how we should characterize these animistic beliefs. It's easy to say that they're kind of polytheistic traditions because they believe in little
Any
gods
gods?
everywhere in nature. But there's a question about whether it's appropriate to call them polytheistic traditions. Often in African traditions or even some Eastern traditions, they talk about spirits instead of gods. And then it's somewhat related to the question that we addressed about pantheism. So when pantheists say that the universe is God, in what sense we can call it God? So if animistic believers ascribe spirituality or divinity to nature, and they believe that spirits are immanent, can we say that they are divine beings or holy beings or something like that? Or are they just ascribing certain kinds of consciousness to different entities throughout nature? And I think there are a lot of interesting philosophical questions emerge here, and they are again, very under discussed.
So, the second question is, I actually discovered you when you were being interviewed by, a Robert Lawrence Kuhn from Closer to Truth. I'm also a big fan of him. His channel were the one who made me interested in philosophy. How does it feel to be interviewed by Robert Lawrence Kuhn from Closer to Truth?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think he is very sharp and he's very well informed. He knows a lot about philosophy. I think someone told me that when Plantinga was interviewed, he said, Plantinga said that he was almost having like a second PhD oral examination because it's so intense. And I'm inclined to agree with him because we spent many, many hours to interview. So when you watch Robert's videos, many of the interviews are very short, like 5 minutes, 10 minutes. But actually, when his team interviews us, they spend like 3, 4 hours easily. They interviewed me last year in London, and they spent like 5 hours. When the interview was over, I was so exhausted. It's a very rewarding experience, but it's quite intense as well. But I really admire his work because he takes philosophy seriously. Film interviews in a very professional setting, so I really appreciate his work.
I think as of now he's the forefront in online philosophy education. I think we have to give him that credit, alongside with Alex O'Connor from Cosmic Skeptic. And I believe those, this is just my own opinion, but I believe those kind of content creators have to be supported by many other fellow philosophers, because I think so here's my here's one of my history of being engaged in philosophy. The first time I learned critical thinking was online by mostly atheistic and skeptical movements. Of course we know them as a new atheism or movement that adjacent to them, but of course they're a very beneficial, and they're really educational. But had I not learned any philosophy, I would be more skeptical and maybe more dismissive towards religion, or and dismissive towards the people that follows the religion as well. My encounter with Robert Lawrence Kuhn, Closer to Truth, is one of the moment that changed my whole perspective about religion, and it really helped me to stop being that hateful and spiteful people. I think to me personally, and I believe many people have the same experience as me, especially those who questioning their religions. An engagement with those kind of contents like Closer to Truth, Cosmic Skeptics, and many other philosophy related contents is really helpful, at least to make us become more critical thinker and then not being hateful in the process. So yeah, this is just my one thought. Do you have any
Yeah, I
response with
think
that?
that's very nice, and I think that's very much in line with what I said about how I look at philosophy. So I engage with philosophers from all kinds of perspectives. And I think that's the exciting part of philosophy. You know, you encounter people who have completely different ideas and beliefs. And, you know, that's very helpful because you look at philosophical problems from many different angles. So even if you disagree with them, they can be very helpful. And I find, you know, philosophy fascinating because there are so many different views. And actually, philosophy would be so boring if everyone agrees about all the issues. And also, in relation to what you said about content creators, you know, I really appreciate people who create YouTube channels like you. I think academics tend to be shy, and I'm not really good at this kind of thing. I never want to watch myself when I'm filmed. And myself as well, but many academics, they think that, you know, we just publish papers, and if you want to know about my work, just read our papers. But I think time is changing, and many people, especially young people, they, you know, at least prefer to watch YouTube videos and TikTok and other things, even just to grasp, you know, what sort of ideas philosophers are developing. So I think it's quite important for academics to be more open to different forms of disseminating their research. So to be honest, I'm not good at being interviewed, and I don't really like it, but I try to do it, and because I think it's important and useful.
Thank you. That sounded more special for you to accept my invitation of interviews. Okay. Last question. Philosophy of religion to me is a very important tool. It helps me in a personal level to develop my understanding of the divine, whether it exists or not. And if so, in what form it might have exist. Safe to say, philosophy of religion is a big deal for me. It affects my worldview, and in some sense affects how I behave in the real world. But what is philosophy of religion to you, Professor? How it affect you in a personal or maybe in a spiritual level?
Yeah, I love philosophy of religion because in this area of philosophy, we address some of the bigger questions in philosophy directly. So we talk about the existence or non-existence of God, the origin of the universe, the foundation of morality, the possibility of the afterlife, and, you know, all of these interesting questions. In certain areas of philosophy, people talk about the very subtle technical issues. And sometimes it's very important to address these issues, but I think it's always important to remember that we do philosophy because ultimately we are interested in these fundamental questions about our existence. That's why I love philosophy of religion. Sadly, many philosophers dismiss philosophy of religion quickly because the majority of analytic philosophers are naturalists, not religious. So they think that, you know, oh, we are not interested in religion. It's just a waste of time to talk about God and other theistic beliefs. But I think that the philosophy of religion is not just for theistic philosophers, because again, you know, in this area of philosophy, we address some of the most fundamental questions in philosophy that are relevant to everyone or almost everyone.
Yeah, that's all the question. Professor, may I say thank you in Japanese language?
Yes.
Okay. Professor Yuji Nagasawa, arigato gozaimasu.
Arigato gozaimasu.
Okay.